Welcome to Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. On today's program, increasing air quality regulations by just a little bit could save more lives. That according to a new study. Find out what states and cities can do to prevent deaths caused by air pollution. But first, as they do on most Fridays, with us now are Susan Demas, the publisher of Inside Michigan Politics, and Ken Sikkema, senior policy fellow at Public Sector Consultants and former Republican legislative leader. The Michigan Information and Research Service, known as MIRS, reported this week that Flint residents contacted Attorney General Bill Schuette's office long before he launched an investigation. Democrats have accused the Republican of ignoring those complaints and only began investigating after news media coverage became so prominent. Susan, is this just politics by the Democrats, or does this delay in investigating the Flint water crisis point to something else?
We're heading into the 2018 election, so there's always going to be politics. And I say that knowing that voting has not started for 2016, but that's the modern era that we live in. And Bill Schuette is obviously looking at a run for governor, and Democrats are conscious of that and will be criticizing anything he does. That said, it is a serious matter that there were complaints before the AG's office that seemed to go unheard. That follows a pattern of people in Flint trying to get a hold of officials at the state and other departments and also the federal government, and not getting a response for a very long time.
Ken, Schuette's office says those complaints were just a handful of emails among the tens of thousands sent to the Attorney General's office and never made it to his attention. What's that say about the importance of citizen complaints sent to the Attorney General's office?
Well, he's going to get a lot of citizen complaints on lots of issues. I think in this case, the fact that they came so many months before he launched his investigation does provide some what I would call minor ammunition that his newfound aggressiveness has some political motives. But as Susan pointed out, I think the reality is that anything he does or doesn't do right now is going to be examined through that lens of his desire to run for governor, and this is just one of those situations.
Was this one-year delay, I'm going to ask you both to speculate a little bit, but was this a one-year delay because Schuette was reluctant to investigate when it might reflect poorly on a fellow Republican, Governor Rick Snyder?
I don't think we have any way of knowing that. I mean, the Attorney General has said that those complaints didn't actually make it up to him. You know, I tend to think that this follows the unfortunate pattern of the Flint water crisis where people in various government agencies and in the governor's office as well seem to be very ready to dismiss complaints from people in Flint as it's the same old people who complain about everything and not taking the health crisis seriously until, frankly, it was too late.
Ken, your thoughts?
Well, nobody in government responded properly to the complaints from citizens of Flint. And, you know, like the emergency manager, like the governor's office, I wouldn't be surprised if the attorney general's office, once they got complaints, made some inquiries over the DEQ, and DEQ responded that everything's copacetic in Flint and the water's safe. So, you know, the attorney general's office isn't alone here in not responding to these complaints until so many months later.
Speaking of the Flint water crisis, the Departments of Environmental Quality and Health and Human Services have restored pay to the six employees who were suspended and charged with crimes related to the Flint water crisis. What do you make of that decision, Susan?
Well, that's the kind of decision that really sticks in the craw of voters, of citizens, I think of all political stripes. It just doesn't seem to make sense. It doesn't matter to them that you're following a certain procedure or protocol. You know, in general, people who are charged with crimes, you know, don't have the advantage of being paid throughout the trial and investigation. And it's just one of those things that, you know, is a pretty bad look. And I think keeps people's attention focused on what is still going on in Flint, which in my mind, you know, is something that certainly shouldn't be forgotten.
Ken, this wasn't required by the Civil Service Commission or anything else. Why do you think they restored the pay to these employees?
Well, let me just say, there seems to me we got a couple of contrary narratives here. One is we're questioning Bill Schuette's motives in charging these people, and then on the other hand, we're questioning whether they should get their pay while they've been charged. I'm frankly, personally, uncomfortable with taking people's pay away just because they've been charged with something. I mean, they haven't been convicted, and I'm guessing that that's was part of the rationale here. We don't know yet whether they are sort of criminally negligent. There hasn't been a trial. As far as I know, they've all pled not guilty, and so frankly, I'm a little uncomfortable just taking people's pay away because they've been charged in this case.
And finally, the Attorney General and the Secretary of State, Ruth Johnson, plan to continue to fight to end straight ticket voting despite a 3-member panel, U.S. Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals ruling against the new law. This is causing significant disruptions for city and county clerks. They need to get ballots to overseas residents very soon, and they still don't know what's what. So, Susan, voters have twice turned down a ban on straight ticket voting. Why is Schuette pursuing this?
Well, this was a law passed by the legislature, signed by the governor. It's been a big Republican priority, and, you know, they feel like it's a matter of fairness. A lot of other states don't have it. But there is a logistical issue in that, you know, voting nowadays doesn't start on November 8th. It starts weeks and weeks in advance with advance voting, early voting for, you know, seniors, for people who are disabled, and especially for military personnel overseas. And so this is an issue that needs to be resolved very quickly. Otherwise, it's going to impact that.
Ken, why are Republicans insistent about ending straight ticket voting?
Well, their argument is that it's kind of a lazy person's way of voting, that you ought to be examining each individual office. But in this case, Bill Schuette's just doing his job. He's defending a law enacted by the legislature, signed by the governor. I do agree that it's got to get resolved very quickly so you can get ballots out there, and it's consistent from whenever that decision is through the election. But, you know, Bill Schuette's doing his job defending a law passed by the legislature.
That's Ken Sikkema, Senior Policy Fellow at Public Sector Consultants, and Susan Demas, publisher of Inside Michigan Politics. Thanks to both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Cheers.
Cheers.
Hi, Tammy.
Hi, Lester.
That's Tammy Coxon with Tammy's Tastings. So it's been an interesting summer. You've been giving us a lot of summer-like drinks. What's on tap this week?
Well, this has been the summer of tiki in Metro Detroit. We've seen a lot of pop-up tiki bars. There's a pop-up tiki bar at the Oakland in Ferndale. Sugar House in Detroit rebranded themselves as a Sugar House Tiki Bar for the spring, and they've just kept going because tiki drinks are so great for summer. Another thing I discovered this summer, which has been around for a long time, is a place called Chin's in Livonia, Chin's Chop Suey. They are maintaining that Chinese restaurant tradition of Cantonese food and tropical drinks served in fun glasses.
So this is really retro.
Absolutely. So one of the cool things about Chin's is that they still have all the decor from the now defunct Chin's Tiki restaurant in Detroit, which was one of the big tiki palaces starting in the late 60s and going out of business, I think, in the 90s. It's a great place to go and really appreciate the completely over-the-top nature of tikiness.
So what's this drink you're making?
Well, in that spirit, we have an elaborately garnished drink called the Test Pilot. This is a Don the Beachcomber classic from 1941. Don the Beachcomber was one of the original founders of the tiki craze.
What's in it? How do you make it?
So like many tiki drinks, the Test Pilot has a long and complicated recipe. The creators of these drinks really wanted to keep their recipe secret, so they would put a dash of this and a few drops of that to make it really hard for their competitors to figure out what was in the drink.
A manual ice crusher, I'm impressed.
That is the classic tiki way of making a drink, actually, would be you'd put some crushed ice and you'd actually put it on like a milkshake mixer just to whiz it up kind of like in a blender. We didn't do that today. We just put a bunch of crushed ice, shook it, and then dumped it all with the crushed ice right in our tiki mug. But of course, you could use another kind of glass. So the base is 1.5 ounces of dark rum. Then we followed that up with 3/4 ounce of white rum. And in the spirit of our Michigan connection here, we used the Waterhill rum from Ann Arbor Distilling. Then we have a 1/2 ounce of an orange liqueur. You could use Cointreau, Curacao, generic triple sec, whatever you have around. 1/2 ounce of freshly squeezed lime juice. 1/2 ounce of falernum. This is one of those classic tiki ingredients. It's a clove and ginger syrup. Got some lime zest in there, too. There's an alcoholic version you can purchase called a velvet falernum, and that's readily available and great for tiki drinks. And then we have a dash of Angostura bitters and 6 drops of Pernod to give it that mystery. What is in this?
So that's a lot of ingredients, and trust me, based on what other people have said, if you haven't tasted this drink and you're interested, go to a bar, order it first. Don't go buy all the liquor, because once you've done that and you don't like it, you're out a lot of money.
I recommend going to one of those tiki bars that we mentioned earlier, those pop-ups that are happening in Detroit this summer. They could probably put together a test pilot for you.
All right. You've got an elaborate straw, a stir, an umbrella, a garnish of cherries. You've got a couple of stalks of mint in there. You can't even get into it to drink it.
That's why it has a straw.
Okay. So I'm usually not a big fan of rum drinks, and I'll bet this is super, super sweet.
No, not at all. The classic tiki drinks were really well balanced, and this one I don't think is too sweet at all. Some people tell me it's too tart.
All right, let me try it. Let's see. No. That's a lot better than I thought it would be.
Absolutely. These are serious cocktails. They have, you know, a lot of rum, and the better rum you use, the better the cocktail will be. They really are about tasting the rum and enjoying the rum.
All right. Thanks.
Cheers.
Up next, a Detroit group threatens a boycott of the Detroit Pistons and the NBA. Find out why. Then, more gas stations will soon be selling alcohol, and not everybody is happy about it. And our resident word expert, Ann Curzan, stops by for some fun Friday phrases. That's in 15 minutes. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. Summer road trips mean big business for gas stations, and if they sell gas and beer and wine, even bigger business. There are already more than 1,800 gas stations that sell alcohol in Michigan, but there are about to be a lot more, and not everyone's happy about that. Michigan Radio's Doug Tribue reports.
Over the 4th of July weekend, the Meyer gas station on Ann Arbor Saline Road in Ann Arbor was busy. 12 pumps with cars coming and going constantly. And full disclosure, Meyer is a financial supporter of Michigan Radio. This gas station has a convenience store, but to buy alcoholic beverages, customers had to go across a large parking lot to the Meyer grocery store. That's because grocery stores were not allowed to sell alcohol at gas stations they also own. But a new state law that went into effect on July 11th lets them apply for a second license at the pumps.
Hello.
Hi.
How are you?
Good, how are you?
Good.
Jennifer Atkinson lives in Whitmore Lake. She'd rather have the option of buying beer and wine while she's filling up.
Well, I moved out here 12 years ago from Nevada, and they do it there. So, I mean, I don't buy that often, but, I mean, it's more convenient if I do want to pick something up. So I find it kind of inconvenient if I'm at the gas station and want to pick something up, and I can't.
Would you have any concerns about it being easier for people to kind of game the system if they're trying to buy, say, underage or inappropriately out of the gas station rather than in the store?
No, because I think it's still going to be monitored.
Lavelle Michael Scott disagrees.
Well, I think that's kind of silly to be selling alcoholic beverages at a gas station. It really don't make no sense.
Scott's not opposed to people buying adult beverages. He just thinks party shops and grocery stores are better at enforcing liquor laws than the gas stations that already sell alcohol.
People got kids out here. You want to make a home safe. You don't want to worry about getting hit from a drunk driver that's stopped for 10 on a pump 3 and a shot of 1800, too, at the same time.
Just to be clear, the new gas station liquor licenses only apply to beer and wine. Republican State Representative Eric Nesbitt sponsored the bill. He represents the 66th District, which includes Van Buren County and part of Kalamazoo County.
The gas station in my township sells beer and wine. There's a lot throughout the state that already do this, and so I felt that this was a common sense way to increase competition and to allow for a more open market.
Nesbitt sees the gas stations run by Meijer, Village Market, Kroger, and others as an extension of the grocery stores.
They're able to sell beer and wine 40 yards away, but they can't at their convenience store location, even though it's on the same piece of property, same owner.
One person who knows the grocery business is Republican State Representative Ray Franz.
I represent the 101st District, which includes Mason, Manistee, Benzie, and Leelanau counties.
Franz is a former butcher, and he used to own his own independent grocery stores. He says Meijer is already a juggernaut, and this gives the chain an extra edge.
They are becoming so dominant in the marketplace that they are killing any kind of local small operations. Competition is a good thing, keeps everybody on their toes, but unfair competition really isn't something that we should be supporting.
Here's what Franz means by unfair competition. Any store in Michigan that sells both alcohol and gas is required to have $250,000 worth of inventory, not including the alcohol and gas. To meet that requirement, mom-and-pop gas stations could fill their buildings floor to ceiling with gum and air fresheners. So instead,
they buy $200,000 or $250,000 worth of stamps to put into a safe just so they say they have that inventory. You can't lock up that much of a small operator's capital and still call it fair competition.
Here's the thing. Under the new law, to use Meijer as an example, the Meijer convenience store won't have to load up on stamps because the inventory in the big grocery store across the parking lot counts for both places. Franz says the small gas station across the street doesn't have that luxury.
I'm not advocating total elimination of all restrictions. I just want everybody to play by the same rules, and this doesn't play by the same rules. That's inherently unfair.
Meijer didn't respond to multiple requests for an interview, but as of late last week, the State Department of Licensing and Regulatory Affairs had received 96 applications for secondary beer and wine licenses. 93 of them are from Meijer. For Stateside, I'm Doug Tribou.
You're listening to Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. The Detroit Association of Black Organizations, Incorporated, is calling for a boycott of the Detroit Pistons and the NBA. The group says the league does not support black businesses in a sport that's dominated by black athletes. It seems to be a real disconnect. Joining me to talk about this is Reverend Horace Sheffield. He is the CEO of the Detroit Association of Black Organizations. Reverend Sheffield, a boycott usually comes after complaints are not addressed. Have you or your members of your group been able to meet or have a conversation with the Pistons owner, Tom Gores, or some team representative?
Well, at the 12th hour yesterday prior to the 5 o'clock community meeting, we did get a call from Aaron Tellum's office asking us to not have the meeting and to set up a time to meet. Now, we've not gone forward with actually calling for what we call bust the ball. We met yesterday and collectively agreed that we will meet with the Pistons and outline all of our grievances and the situations that we think need to be addressed.
So bust the ball is the boycott, the call for the boycott.
Yes.
It's not implemented yet.
Collective buying campaign is the preferred word I use to describe it, yes.
So you were involved when the NCAA Final Four college basketball came to Detroit in 2009. You raised some of the same issues with the NCAA. Can you tell us about that effort?
Yeah, well, I mean, basically, the local host committee in that situation, even though they raised money and they put a package together, didn't have much to say about who business was done with. And one of the things that I discovered, even with the list, for example, of transportation vendors, that the only and the oldest, one of the oldest cab companies in Detroit, a black-owned cab company, wasn't listed among those vendors for preferred transportation. In addition to that, unlike today where everyone wants to be downtown, most of the hotel space that was being advertised and promoted was outside of Detroit. So, of course, I raised a stink about it. The NCAA, to their credit, did create a mechanism and a vehicle through which those grievances were to be heard and hopefully addressed. And as you may or may not know from the meeting that we had last night, we indicated that it was rather co-opted by them basically involving another black organization that we understand got a sizable charitable contribution, but none of the grievances were ever addressed.
How aware are the NBA athletes themselves or fans of the NBA? How aware are they of your concerns?
Well, you know, I was sharing last night, as well as Chief Godby, who, you know, as a Detroit chief of police, had a lot of interaction with professional athletes, as well as I have. Got friends, I know people, and this has been a concern. I mean, their voice is muted and muffled because they almost feel that there's retribution if they engage in this kind of conversation. But there is a feeling that they generate billions of dollars. The share of people who watch and view the NBA by people of color is estimated at 65%. And there's far more money generated by outside of ticket sales than there is ticket sales. So they're aware of it. The degree to which they're willing to get involved is something we discussed last night, simply because, I mean, you know, it's almost like when Ford workers worked for Ford Motor Company before the UAW Ford strike and collective bargaining agreement with UAW, you just couldn't be pro-union in a non-union shop. So it's probably to their detriment if they would get involved.
How do you measure whether the NBA or the Pistons are doing enough business with black-owned or black-operated businesses?
Well, by them making the information available. I mean, that's the preeminent point of all of this, and wanting to have conversation from the very beginning is refute us. I mean, show us we're wrong. And I've talked with many, many people who are on the inside and say that it's woeful. I mean, Tom Gore's own company, Platinum Partners, is, you know, 38 major partners, and there's only two Asians, one Hispanic, and no African Americans, and five women. You know, I'm concerned about the lack of women. We know that the league has done a great job, or at least those that cover the league have done a great job of diversity. You see women, you see men of color, you see all kinds of folks commentating on the game, but we're talking about the bottom line of the game, that we ought to be participants in that as well.
I want to step back just a little bit and take your issue you're having with Tom Gores and the Pistons and expand on it. We've seen a lot of difficulty in Detroit of getting black contractors work, of getting black people in the neighborhoods work in the very city they live, while a lot of outside people come in and get jobs. So is this a small part of that larger picture?
It is, and when you speak of Detroit, we have a phrase at Dable called Detroit Generational Residence, and that we're going to make certain Detroit is 2.0 plus one, not minus one. The notion of people
Explain what you mean by that.
Well, the new slogan is Detroit 2.0 being remade, okay? And many people who have been long-term residents who never left, who've endured inordinate crime, paid unbelievable insurance premiums, I mean, suffered through the worst times of the city.
And high taxes with no services.
No question.
Barely any services.
Are not the beneficiaries of this rebirth. And so when you talk about Detroit 2.0, the remade city, we wanted to be plus one, which are those of us who are generational residents, not minus one, those of us who are in that same category. But here's what I suggest. I suggest that if people argue that some of these entities don't have the capacity. We lifted up in our meeting yesterday Illich's complex, Hockey Town, where he had a goal of 51% local participation, tremendous minority participation, built capacity among individuals. I have a lady in my church who's a skilled tradesperson who had a company that they contracted with. I think that's a model, and hockey doesn't have the percentage of African Americans. I mean, it's not a sport dominated by us. And yet Illich has gone to great lengths in his building project and the vendors and the participation of businesses that will be in the new site to make certain that there's local and African American presence. Now, if he can do that, and I know that he got public money, I understand that there's a different spectrum when the public's helping to finance to some degree what you're doing, but we've had other folks that have been publicly financed that have been woeful, but it is a good example of what can be done.
I want to ask you, does it make a difference that the Pistons don't play in Detroit proper? They play outside of the city.
Well, that's a great question, too, because when you talk about community benefits agreement, you have to now redefine who the community is. Is it where that stadium or that arena is located? Or is it the community of people who actually buttress your bottom line, who view your product, who buy tickets and come to your game? So I think where the actual arena is situated has nothing to do with those who should be the beneficiaries of it. You know, if we contribute to the degree that we do in terms of viewership, whether we live in Detroit or we live in Decatur, Michigan, doesn't matter.
Final question, when will you be meeting with the Pistons?
Well, I'm going to make a call back today to Iron Tellum's office and try to set up a meeting. Our hope is that they'll come here to our facility. We don't really want to go out there because there's a significant number of us. We promised that we would all meet together, that I wouldn't be the sole voice or lone ranger, but we'd make certain that everyone was a part of that meeting so we can come to some resolution.
The Reverend Horace Sheffield is the CEO of the Detroit Association of Black Organizations, a group of business leaders and others who want the Pistons and the NBA to do more to support black businesses. Thanks for talking with us.
Thank you.
We reached out to the Pistons organization about this issue. They did not immediately respond to our request for an interview. This is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. Well, time for a little wordplay. We ask you to send in phrases or terms that are a little weird, and University of Michigan English professor Ann Curzan would try to track down where they started, where they came from. She studies linguistics and the history of English language and is the host of That's What They Say here on Michigan Radio. So we had three phrases that were submitted from Robert Keller. Don't upset the apple cart. What's that all about?
This was a fun one to look at. I think in my own head, I just assumed it was an apple cart. Don't tip it over.
Right.
Right. Not apparently where this started.
Oh.
It looks like an apple cart in the middle of the 18th century referred to the human body.
Oh.
And the analogies here were, for example, in around the same period, a bread basket was your stomach, a potato trap was your mouth, and the apple cart was your body. Which means that you had expressions to capsize someone's apple cart was to knock them down.
Oh, wow.
from there to ruin someone's plans. But there are some great quotes. In the 19th century, it looks like you had both meanings in play, and you get things like a little kid falls down and you say to them, "Oh, you upset your apple cart."
Okay, I get that. That makes sense. Right. So metaphors just change over the centuries, and we're still holding on to this even though we don't know the second idea of the metaphor rather
right.
than the first.
Right. So now it's just to ruin someone's plans is to upset their apple cart.
So we had another one that was submitted. Lisa Allen Coast submitted Hell in a Handbasket, which I think probably all of us have heard at one point or another. So what's the history of that
right.
one?
And many of us have used in various ways when we're feeling upset about how things are going. For a while, people thought that this one was just a 20th century expression, but we now have it back to 1865, Civil War period. The first written quote we have is, again, 1865, and it was this concern that these prisoners were going to go to Chicago and kill people and that they would, quote, send abolitionists to hell in a handbasket.
Ah, okay.
But it's probably the case that if it's first written down in 1865, it was in circulation before that. Now, why a handbasket? We don't have a great explanation. It's alliterative, so that's nice. There were expressions in circulation such as go to heaven in a wheelbarrow. So go to hell in a handbasket.
These things stick around because they have such, you know, resonance with people, I assume. We have one more here. This one's from Margaret Feringer. Do you know how to pronounce that name? Okay. Margaret Feringer. And it always reminds me of the Depression. We didn't have two nickels to rub together.
And do you say it as two nickels to rub together?
I've heard it. I don't use this phrase myself, but I've heard it a lot, especially from my grandfather who used to say they didn't have two nickels to rub together, you know, that kind of a thing. So it's been around for a while. I just assume, you know, if you don't have two, that means you only got one. That means you're poorer, right?
Right. And it turns out that one of the questions is, which coins are you trying to rub together?
Oh, so there's other places, other regions that use different coins?
Or? Well, we've had some inflation over the years, it appears, in this expression. Barry Popick, who is a great word detective, has found that we have the expression to rub two pennies together back to 1902. 1903, he also gets rub two quarters together. Around the same time, rub $2 together. By 1919, rub two nickels together, and 1969, couldn't rub two dimes together.
Interesting. Now, I've not heard any of those other ones. It's always just been two nickels in my experience. I wonder why the change of inflation one, but I noticed it went down right after World War One when you went to two pennies. So I don't know.
Right. And of course, they're all capturing the same thing, which is that you've only got one of whatever this fairly small amount of money is, which means you don't have money to throw around or perhaps even to buy the things you need.
That's Ann Curzan. She is English professor at the University of Michigan and host of That's What They Say, which airs on Sundays here on Michigan Radio at 9:35 a.m. She's also available as a podcast. Thanks for coming in.
Thanks for inviting me.
Still to come, remember those air quality warnings last week? Well, a new study suggests states and cities need to step up air pollution controls. Plus, we get a reaction to a judge's decision regarding the firing of a transgender person. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. You might have heard this on the news. A person who wanted to transition from a male to female identity has lost a lawsuit against her former employer. RG and GR Harris Funeral Home fired Amy Stevens for planning to dress as a female at work. The owner said he believes gender is an immutable, God-given gift. Attorneys for Stevens say the ruling will make it nearly impossible to enforce any civil rights law if an employer can simply say the law is against its religious beliefs. Attorneys for the funeral home say the ruling is a victory for religious liberty and a check on government intrusion. Joining us to talk about the ramifications of this ruling is Emily Devendorf. She's president of the Lansing Association for Human Rights. What does this mean for transgender people in the workplace?
Well, this ruling could have some pretty far-reaching implications for a couple of reasons. When the EEOC challenged this funeral business, it was only the second case of its kind to do so. The other case was actually filed on the very same day in Florida and has since been settled for $150,000. With the business agreeing to adopt a trans-inclusive anti-discrimination policy and do trainings on anti-trans discrimination. So it looked like everything was going in the direction of recognizing trans people as equal and protected under Title VII, and I'm sure we'll get to that a bit later. But when this ruling came down, it has set the standard for businesses being able to legally violate established civil rights non-discrimination laws in order to practice and, they would say, although I would argue it doesn't need it, protect religious expression.
What larger implications are there for not just transgender people, but others to whom a business might find religious objections to serving or employing?
Well, now that a decision has stated that you can ignore civil rights laws based on your own beliefs and essentially biases, since that's what a lot of our beliefs translate into, that can be applied to any of the protected classes under our civil rights laws. Now, another thing that the judge said in his decision on this case was that his decision was partially based on the fact that trans people are not specifically listed as protected classes under the Civil Rights Act. Although the EEOC has interpreted Title VII to protect them, they are not explicitly protected under our Civil Rights Act. So he went back to the fact that we don't have laws in place that specifically name trans people to say that this religious expression could be turned into legal discrimination, essentially.
This was a ruling by a federal judge. There are no federal laws, as you've explained, protecting transgender people. There are no state laws protecting transgender people. What's that say to you about where the law and society are regarding transgender people?
Well, this is a clear attempt to ensure that trans people do not achieve equal rights anytime soon. And what is particularly interesting about this case and this decision is that it is an example of conservatives trying to play both sides of this. Because conservatives in Michigan and also outside of our state and other states trying to gain protections on the statewide level, conservatives in Michigan used the fact that the EEOC interpreted Title VII to protect transgender people as an excuse to try to not include trans people in our attempt to amend our state Civil Rights Act. So the Republicans themselves were saying trans people are already protected. The EEOC says so. And now we're getting a ruling that says if trans people are protected under Title VII, it's not specific enough, and we can ignore it if we have a strongly held religious belief.
And so the bottom line is federal protection, state protection, neither is happening, and the legislature was saying the federal government, Title VII, would protect them, and it doesn't. And that was the reason they didn't add them into protection under Michigan's civil rights law. So now there is no protection guaranteed so far as this ruling is concerned, for transgender people. And it puts a lot of questions about other people who might not be protected as well as we thought they were.
Absolutely. That's exactly the case.
Okay. What do you think is going to happen next?
Well, we don't know yet if the EEOC is going to appeal this case. We do know that Judge Cox, who did release this ruling, he noted that dress code could qualify as unlawful discrimination, the dress code at this business, but it wasn't part of the EEOC's case. That is another angle that could be used on this. But again, that brings us back to the ambiguity in Title VII that needs to be addressed, because the reason Title VII was interpreted to protect trans people is because it prohibits discrimination based on sex, and that also includes preferences, expectations, or stereotypes that are sex or gender-based, but it does not name trans people. So I think we would come up against some of the same challenges there, which means that at the state level, on the federal level, our non-discrimination policies have to be clear about the fact that trans people need to be protected equally under the law, and those laws need to be enumerated in order to reflect that.
Emily Diefendorf is president of the Lansing Association for Human Rights. Thanks for taking the time with us.
Yes, thank you for having me.
You're listening to Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. A new study finds reducing air pollution by just a little more would save about 9,000 lives each year in the U.S. Detroit is one of the cities the study finds could benefit the most from slightly tighter air pollution regulations. Kevin Cromar is the lead author of the study. He's an assistant professor at the NYU School of Medicine, and he joins us by Skype. Let's start with the basics. What kind of air pollution is the biggest concern?
We looked at ozone as well as particulate matter pollution, and depending on where you live, either ozone or particulate matter can have the strongest health impacts.
What kind of health problems do these pollutants cause or make worse?
Typically, they increase the risk of both cardiovascular and respiratory health outcomes. And these can be so severe they can actually lead to increased risk of premature death. Outside of mortality, we also see increased risk of hospital admissions and emergency department visits, increased risk of heart attacks. And then on the lower end of the scale, we see where people can get sick that makes them not able to go to work or to school. And we're concerned with these health impacts as well.
That gets to the economics of this, and I want to talk about that later. But let's talk about what are the sources of these pollutants. I know we talk about ozone, ground-level ozone, quite a bit. We talk about fine particulates from diesel and from coal-burning power plants. But a lot of those have been seeing tighter restrictions, particularly diesel fuel. So what more can be done?
Yeah, that's a good question. So these pollutants come from a wide variety of sources, on-road sources, area sources like our homes and our buildings, point sources, industrial activity and power generation. The specific sources of pollution in each city is slightly different. And so really this report doesn't focus too much on prescribing what should be done to fix the problem. We recognize that these problems are unique in each city, and so the solutions to it will actually need to be city-driven and unique as well.
So we usually rely on state agencies or the Environmental Protection Agency to deal with these kinds of pollutants. What can cities do locally?
If you were interested in knowing what the air pollution levels were in your community, there's a great number of resources you can go to find that information. But if you want to know the health impacts of those levels of air pollution, there wasn't any information readily available to you, both for the public or for the air quality managers who have to make such important decisions. This report, we hope, will be a source of reliable information that can inform the ongoing discussions on what cities should do. Every city is a little bit different, like I mentioned. We hope that the public and air quality managers can really work together to make plans that best suit both the needs and the preferences of the local communities they serve.
Of course, there are some cities who actually are downwind of other major cities, and they can't do much about the ozone problems or the fine particulates that drift into their town if the other city isn't doing much on its part. What can be done? I mean, this is not totally a local problem. This is something that can be caused by a city hundreds of miles away.
Oh, absolutely. If you look at the maps in the report that show the pollution levels across the country, you can see that pollution often is a regional problem. And for any one given jurisdiction, your options might be limited. So there's no way that you could control all the pollution down to zero. In the Detroit area, we found that the particle pollution levels were just slightly higher than the levels recommended by the American Thoracic Society. And even making a small improvement in the particle pollution levels, we see has a dramatic impact on public health. The level recommended is 11. Detroit was somewhere around 11.3. And that small difference was approximately 21 additional deaths per year.
The Detroit metro area landed as 16th on the list of cities that could benefit from further air pollution restrictions. There's been a lot of concern about the southwest part of Detroit in many reports in the past. When Michigan faced ozone alerts just last week, the Department of Environmental Quality talked about voluntary measures such as not topping off the tank when you're filling your vehicle, not using gas-powered or two-cycle, two-stroke lawnmowers. Are voluntary efforts enough to solve this problem and maybe make that difference between 11 and 11.3? As you pointed out in your study.
In terms of short-term interventions the public takes to try and reduce short-term risk, that's probably not going to lower the annual levels too much. What it will do is hopefully reduce the peak levels on specific days. There really needs to be coordinated planning on how can we reduce these pollution levels over the long term, in addition to those great efforts to reduce pollution in the short term.
Let's hone down on that just a little bit, because cities don't often have regulatory powers that state agencies or the EPA does, as I mentioned before. So what can a city do?
There's no restrictions in the Clean Air Act that prevent cities to take actions on their own accord. The federal air quality standards are applied at the county level. And then states are responsible to put together a plan for any county that doesn't meet federal air quality guidelines. So that's a formalized process that's made a big difference in air quality over time.
Oh, we talk about ordinances, banning traffic levels. I mean, I'm just trying to imagine what that might look like.
One example I can give you is in New York City. We worked with the mayor's office and other organizations to try and reduce the sulfur content of heating oil in buildings. Now, that's a very specific source of pollution. Most parts of the country don't have heating oil in their buildings. But just by that passing two policies to reduce sulfur content, New York City experienced the cleanest wintertime air quality they had in 50 years. The solutions need to be city-specific, and with some collaborative effort, I really think it's possible to make small improvements in air quality that can make a big difference in public health.
Now, we're talking about lives here, but you know, while we're talking about health problems, often these concerns come down to economics. What kind of costs to the economy would tighter restrictions mean versus additional health care costs that we pay as a result of this air pollution?
This report doesn't explicitly show the economic costs or benefits.
Well, there have been plenty of studies that do look at that, though. I'm sure you're familiar.
Absolutely. And I think that economic considerations are critical in making any policy decisions. That's why I alluded to earlier that every city has different preferences where they want to invest their resources. This report is not meant to shame any city. It's not meant to necessarily compel cities that they must take action. What it's intended to do is provide accurate numbers that can be used as part of that discussion on how cities can best meet their preferences and priorities. But absolutely, there's economic costs to improving air quality, and there's economic costs for not improving air quality. So that's an important consideration that cities need to keep in mind.
Kevin Cromar is the lead author of the study, Estimated Excess Morbidity and Mortality Caused by Air Pollution Above the American Thoracic Society Recommended Standards. We have links to the study on our website at michiganradio.org. Dr. Cromar, thanks very much.
Thank you so much. I appreciate your time.
If you're in Detroit this weekend, don't worry, your eyes are not deceiving you. That is a Viking ship docked at the Detroit Yacht Club on Belle Isle. The Draken Harald Harfagre has been visiting North America after it sailed from Norway to Iceland, Greenland, and then through the St. Lawrence Seaway to the Great Lakes. Joining us to talk about the ship is the Captain Bjorn Arlander. Tell us about that name.
The name of the ship is Draken Harald Hårfagre. Draken is dragon, and Harald Hårfagre was the first king in Norway. He was a Viking, and so he was the first king of all Norway.
So how closely does the ship replicate what might have been used close to 1,000 years ago?
It's a replica. Everything is authentic. It's a wooden. Everything is made in oak, and everything, we have no mechanic winches or anything. We work by hands, everything. And yeah, it's very authentic.
So I read that when you got into U.S. waters, you were surprised by a law that requires you to pay a piloting fee of up to $400 an hour. How's that affected your plans for your visit to North America?
Yeah, you know, we was invited to participate in Tall Ships Challenge, a race in the lakes. And we was in a conference in Quebec in Canada, and we was talked to the authorities for the pilots, and they say we was not required any pilots in the Great Lakes because we was under 35 meters. But when we come here, it was another thing with Americans pilot association. They said that we need a pilot.
Right.
So it was a shock for us. But we are not blaming the pilots. They follow the rules. It's a decision made by the U.S. Coast Guard, and it's a decision made in the Congress. So we can't change that.
Right. It's the law. You don't have a choice. I think maybe somebody ought to be rethinking that for not-for-profit organizations or demonstrations like yours. I want to talk about what you're doing in Detroit. You'll be giving tours while docked at the Detroit Yacht Club on Belle Isle this weekend.
Saturday and Sunday is open for public, and we are guests at the Yacht Club, and they have to decide how many they can let into the Yacht Club. But for our sake, everybody's welcome on board.
And you don't have to be a Yacht Club member to be there. Mm-hmm. You can go in.
You can go in there and go down to the ship. And so I hope it will work good. Normally we stay in a more public place, but they have been very nice to invite us to this club, so we stay in there.
I think you'll be surprised how many people are at Belle Isle during the weekend. What was it like to sail the Great Lakes versus the Atlantic?
It's much more smoother here, of course. We had very heavy weather out in the North Atlantic, and it was cold. There was icebergs, and was a whole different story. Here it's like vacation for us.
Okay. Where do you go from Detroit?
Then we are going down to Oswego, and that's not because we like to be here in the lakes, but it's too costly for us. So we're going to go down in Erie Canal, down through New York State, and down to Hudson River in New York.
Great.
And when we come into Erie Canal, we are not required any pilots. Then we can go slowly by our own.
Well, I'm glad you got to visit the Great Lakes. I can't apologize on behalf of the U.S. Coast Guard, but I'm hoping that maybe somebody will take a look at the whole fee structure and enjoy your time here in the United States.
Thank you for this, and I must say thank you to the American people who make it possible for us to come all the way up to Chicago and back. Without the support, we shouldn't be able to afford to go so far. Also, thanks for the pilot who has been on board. They have been very polite and nice, but very costly also. Yeah. So thank you.
That's Bjorn Ollander. He is the captain of the Draken Harald Hårfagre. He's been visiting North America and is in Detroit at Belle Isle at the Detroit Yacht Club this weekend. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Stateside's producers are Allie Billings, Mercedes Mejia, Mike Blank, and Lindsay Scullin. The executive producer is Joe Lindstroth. I'm Lester Graham. Thanks for listening.